He's making a deal with Juregi right now, that's why it's gone.
Code personal representative, claims against the estate, section 141. We have, in terms of the presentation of claims and time limits, cut the non-claim statute down to essentially 4 months. That's one of the primary changes here. Now, as you all know, we don't have a technical non-claim statute in the state of Oregon. Most states, the non-claim statute is an absolute bar. This does not change that basic philosophy in our present code. 4 months is really a priority period. So what we've done is cut the, if you file your claim within 4 months under the new code, where it was 6 months under the old code, then your claims will have a priority for payment. Claims not presented within 12 months of the date of first publication of notice of interested persons, however, are barred from payment. And then in subsection 4, we have kind of an escape hatch here. If a claim is presented after the 12 months, it's still not barred if the court finds that the late presentment was caused by mistake, inadvertent surprise, or excusable neglect.
Mr. Chairman, what are you going to do about the claim that doesn't arise until long after this period? You've got the dead doctor, you've left the sponge, and the victim is not discovered until 3 years after it was left there.
The guy
doesn't know it. He doesn't discover it until 3 years. We've got a statute of limitations on medical malpractice now in foreign bodies that is dependent in part upon the date of discovery.
Is that covered? Yeah.
No. I can also think of other things. Supposing you got the guy as an architect or an engineer.
But what's the situation?
A lawyer. Malpractice claims that aren't discovered.
What's the situation today?
I've forgotten it's
2 years after the date of discovery.
There's no event more than 7 years after the event. I think we made some
change in 67.
To engineers and to architects and so on.
2 years ago.
But it's a real problem. You get a dead work visa.
I don't see any choice under this existing statute except to come under four. And that means reopening the state. It may involve reopening the state.
What if all the assets are
final accounts filed? Of course, depending upon the time of filing the final account.
Mr. Chairman,
Oh, you have reopened
consideration of this particular question because beginning on page 60, we have provisions for action and suits that may clarify the problem.
Well, let's move to that one right now. Page 60, section 165.
Could Mr. Allison respond? It seems to me that this came up before the Law Improvement Committee. We were going to cover this problem. My recollection wrong?
Where are those amendments that I asked about coming in, Bob?
Your pardon?
Where are those amendments on my two bills?
The one on the personal injury or property damage covered by insurance will probably come in right after section 141. Because it is an exception to the non-claim period to the extent that the charity proceeds are available. Your other provision comes in as subsection 2 of section ORF 121090 is amended by section 167.
Yeah, so it's being
What happens today? We have those statutes that we passed here 2 years and 7, I believe. And death occurs, a doctor dies, and your estate is completely distributed 18 months. And then some person discovers that this doctor left a sponge when he performed an operation, and as a result, he's permanently injured. What's his recourse today?
Not very much, I'm afraid. That's why I think the one bill that I have that just goes to this one asset that's available for one creditor or class of creditors or claimants, that is, the liability insurance policy, which is in section 141, I think,
Well, then, but how, in this, how are we changing the present situation?
Well,
question one. Question two, should we?
Unless we also change 167, I think, if Because right now, it's up in the air as to whether or not you have to present a claim on a bodily injury or property damage to the to a personal representative, is what I'm going to call it. I think if in, the thing I would request, the one bill that Mr. Zollinger says that I don't need, which I, is the second of those two bills, that's the one which would require an amendment to section 167 of this.
Yeah.
That, the idea there is that you don't have to first present the claim. But I'm afraid this 12109, this section 167 of the bill, is going to nullify.
Further, Senator, here 7 on definitions, claim includes liabilities and receiving or arising in contract in tort or otherwise. That supports your view.
Yeah, and that's what I'm afraid of. Is it's going to drastically cut even there's ordinary statutes of limitation. By these, you're going to say you're going to cut off everything at the time the final account is filed. You're going to knock out these, some of these 1 and 2 year, or 2 year statutes of limitation, and there's an indicator.
Flat out.
Unless we make some.
I don't find it consoling. I know that we spent a lot of time working with it on the Uniform Probate Code, and I know there's a solution for it in the Uniform Probate Code. I could try to check it through.
But one thing we can't do, we can't hold up distribution of assets for 7 years or anything like
I understand that.
But on your other thing, we could incorporate those bills into this.
I think you've got the, except that the fact is Bob didn't know when he was asked to do that, that Ed Smith had some language he wanted. Given that that language, Ed, can we come back to this section, Mr. Chairman? Before we send this bill out of committee.
Yeah, well, let's do that.
And I don't want to take up time now, and I didn't want to flag it, but there's these two problems in connection with Article 5 here, and then over here in connection with Part 3 actions and suits.
Do you want me to send you the Uniform Code language?
I think so.
You probably already got it.
Is that in the fifth draft?
Yes.
It's not in the fourth.
Well, it's not easy. It's in all the drafts.
Their solution is much better than what you've got here.
Pardon me?
I say their solution is much better
really?
Than what you've got here.
Really? I'm going to check it out. Maybe you're right.
And what I've heard is that take us.
We're at 142 now.
All right.
Form and verification of claims. Claim must be in writing. Describe the nature and amount due. State the names and addresses of the claimant. Be accompanied by the affidavit. Unless somebody has some specific questions, it's pretty much the boilerplate. The presentment of a claim or any defect may be waived by a personal representative or by the court. We want to set it up so the personal representative can require that the claim be filed in the right way, but if the milk bill comes in the wrong way, you pay it without being in trouble. Under section 144, when it appears that there is written evidence of a claim, the personal representative can require the production of that evidence. Claims on debt due, pretty much, if a claim on a debt due is presented, an allowance shall be in the amount of the debt due. That's pretty much straightforward. Claims on secured debts due, it's highly technical. I don't really know what one can say to, essentially, the secured claimant has two options. He can file his claim and have it paid, or he can act on his security, one of the two. Would you want to add anything to that?
No, that's the
claims on debts not due. If the debt isn't due, the claimant really has two alternatives. Maybe I can read that one so quickly. A claim on a debt not due, whether or not the creditor holds security, may be presented as a claim on a debt due. If the claim is allowed, allowance shall be in an amount equal to the value of the debt on the date of allowance. In short, if the debt isn't due, we want the guy to be able to file his claim, a discount the value based upon the fact that he's being paid off earlier and clean the thing up in the estate. Claims on contingent and unliquidated debts gets a good deal more complicated. You've got to present the claim on the contingent or unliquidated debt. If the debt becomes absolutely liquidated, then you just pay it in the normal order of events. The creditor and personal representative may determine by agreement, arbitration, or compromise the value of the debt and clean the thing off. If it's contingent, he can really compromise the contingent claim in order to resolve it. Or in B here, 3B, the court may order the personal representative to make distribution of the estate, but retain sufficient funds to pay the claim if and when the debt becomes absolutely liquidated. Now, the debt, if you have this contingent claim, there are very little ways in terms of due process that you can close it off. You can authorize the personal representative to make a compromise, but if you can't make the compromise, you simply got to have some way here not to hold the estate on them, but to require the setting aside of funds to pay the contingent claim if it becomes due. I don't have any more to say on that. And then in 149, we wanted to make it quite clear that the personal representative could compromise a claim against the estate. The claim of the personal representative shall be filed with the court within the time required for the presentment of claims.
Just for the sake of reverting back to that other proposition, common law was that if the decedent named or testator named the person as a personal representative and he was a creditor, discharged the debt unless there were insufficient assets to pay all creditors. And there's some meaning to the words money treated as money in his hands rather than assets in his hands.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to change it.
I think Mr. Love is up in the law library.
Well, it's right here in this book. I'll tell Mr. Senator Ryan.
And we authorize the personal representative or any interested person to have the personal representative's claim considered by the court on the final account. 151, upon the expiration of 4 months after the first publication of notice to interested persons, the personal representative shall, he makes provision for the spouse and children ordered by the court, expenses of administration.
I wonder if that shouldn't be dependent.
Yeah.
It merely tells the personal representative to pay the claims after 4 months. Section 152 gives the order of payment of claims. And I don't think that this is any different from our existing order of payment of claims, other than the elimination of the distinction between real personal property.
I see that in this, that we do provide for a plain and decent funeral, which informs the amendment we made earlier.
Major?
Somewhat different context. Yes?
There is a change in the order of payment.
It certainly is. Yeah. The old one was, began funeral charges and expenses of last sickness, and it's down in the number C situation now.
And now expense of administration, they're second, and they were number one.
Right.
You'll notice, Mr. Chairman, that the Public Welfare Commission and the Oregon State Water Control are both played in this section.
Yeah.
Bill, could you summarize this 153 to 151?
Yes, the basic provision there is that heretofore it's been necessary for the personal representative to act upon a claim, and if it is not acted upon and deemed rejected, we reverse that here. And many attorneys object to that. They say that they lay around their desks and so on, and the presumption or the effect would be that they're allowed now. And whereas before they've been rejected.
This is probably one of the 20 or 25 most important policy changes we've made.
Yeah.
Sure is. And Tom, are you going to get to Eugene at 4?
If I make it by 4:30,
I've got to be there. Have you got your car?
Yes.
I've got to be there at 4:30, so you have to be tomorrow.
Where does this, why don't we go over to page 58, discharge of encumbrances, just the next last day.
Well, the basic problem here is there's no burden upon the personal representative to pay these obligations, which are voluntary. He may pay them, but he'll have a claim against the distributee of the asset against which the lien existed to be reimbursed for the claim, but he has no obligation to pay. And it's contrary if the encumbrance is an involuntary one, in which case he has to pay it. Now, unless the will provides otherwise, the devisee of specifically devised property may require that an encumbrance thereon be fully or partially discharged out of other assets of the estate not specifically devised if A, the encumbrance is an involuntary encumbrance, or the encumbrance is a voluntary encumbrance, and the will directs full or partial discharge of the encumbrance out of other assets. But we've got another section which provides the mere direction to pay debt shall not come within this section. See? Nor shall it have anything to do with the apportionment of the tax.
Could we say that under, not necessarily our old law, but under the old common law, if a property was encumbered by a mortgage, then the deceased had a debt. If you leave property which is encumbered by a mortgage to a specific legatee, under the old law, the old common law, that meant that the estate had to pay off the mortgage on the property. We changed that here, and I think it's consistent with present Oregon law, that the devisee of a piece of real property takes it subject to the mortgage which is on the property. But under certain circumstances, that might very probably not be what the testator intended. And you have a whole series of specific situations here in which, and they're generally delineated these involuntary encumbrances, in which we can see that if the testator knew what the problem was, he probably would have intended these involuntary encumbrances to be paid off. Does that summarize it all, Bill?
Yeah.
Yeah. Section 163 gives the personal representative the authority to redeem estate property from foreclosure sale. That's about all of those, isn't it, Bill?
Yeah.
Have we finished up this part three, actions and suits, which would take us up to Article 6?
Let's raise that same question
earlier. That's what we're going to turn to that.
I think that probably we can get one number of non-residents for the name that you and I and Robin Bob and some resident insurance people sit down with those two ideas I have. We can go without having to bother each other.
Yeah, and with Lundy.
That's what I meant. Lundy and yourself.
Where are you now, sir?
Can I say we're Article 6?
One more that I think the committee should be entitled to be advised about, and some of the method of taking care of us on that appeal part. Volunteer for something, but something ought to be Mr. Wilson, and I'd like to know it myself. Our basic concept was we put this in the civil court, and there we were, and we'd follow court procedures there. That's our basic
concept.
What the hell are you hearing? I might say an evening program.
Is it convenient one of the other hard-working senators? We want you to know that the only reason we appear in this costume is that we work day and night and feel it's a suit. 8 hours, 12 hours a day is long enough for a suit. We stopped
your shoes on?
On where did we stop? Section 168. Now, Mr. Allison, would you
Mr. Chairman, we have as our team this evening Mr. Otto Frohnmeyer from Medford, who is a member of the advisory committee since it started, and Mr. Gene Piazza from Medford, who for many years was a very active, able member of the Senate of the State Probate Procedure Committee. And these people will sit at the end if it's agreeable and take over where we left off.
Fine. Otto and Gene, I don't know whether Stan informed you or not, but
I did my best, Mr. Chairman, and pray for him on the way you're doing.
Did you? Yes. Very well. I'll say nothing further. Whichever one of you are assigned the task and start with Section 168.
Do you prefer that I remain seated?
Oh, heaven, yes.
The first section
perhaps 168.
Pardon me, just for the record, I'm sure you know all these gentlemen. This is Otto Holmeyer. And Gene Gadd.
I wanted to say to you that several of us agree that notwithstanding the fact we started your day at 6 this morning, we're proud that you're here at the time.
Thank you.
I'll have my coat off in a minute.
The dudes all feel that way.
They do all this about the television people.
Yeah, they got the camera going to the blue shirt.
Section 168 deals with probably one of the most difficult problems in the probate field, and that is, how do you allocate the income that's received during the course of administration, that is, from the date of death up until the time the estate is distributed? These sections are adapted to the Uniform Principal and Income Act, which is in force in Oregon. It's sections ORS 129.010 through 129.140. These sections, of course, were adopted primarily for the interpretation, or the direction, rather, of trustees of trust. But essentially, the probate of an estate is no different than a trust. So after a great amount of time spent on this subject by the two committees, we finally determined that we should adopt, as a part of the probate code, the same method of allocation of income as is used in the allocation of income in trust. Subsection 1, in effect, says that where there is a specific divide of property, the devisee is entitled to the net income of that particular piece of property. That is, you take the gross income, you take off the expenses, and he gets that. As to the undivided property, that is, that goes into the residue under subparagraph 2, that's allocated among all of the other residuary beneficiaries in accordance with their share of the estate. Essentially, again, the net, the division of the net.
Thank you, Mr.
The way you got this worded, maybe you're wrong, maybe in line 26, but here we've got again an invalid delegation of legislative power. Supposing after this effective date of this act, Congress is in section 2056 of the Internal Revenue Code, don't we have to tie this down to the Internal Revenue Code of 1954 as amended as of a certain date? Maybe the effective date of this act, or maybe the effective date you want. But otherwise, Congress can amend our statute for us by simply amending that act.
Very frankly, I'm not familiar with this problem. I know what you're talking about, but I don't recall that was discussed in any of our meetings. Do you know whether it was, Dan?
That's the way we've approached other problems in the legislature for too many years.
We almost have to type this down to the search down.
Yeah.
Well, I think that it does.
All right. Ordinarily, this kind of a reference doesn't.
When it says as amended, it doesn't say as it may be.
That's been construed to mean that they amended again. Tax bills every time by making the Internal Revenue Code of 1954, section SAFA, as amended as of a certain date.
It certainly is better to have that reference. I'm assuming that's what they mean, and that will take care of it.
Well, I thought it would be good. Or if he wants to take a check on it.
I'm familiar with the problems, of course, and I have to say amended because it has been amended since the original enactment. If it were another constitutional delegation, it could only mean as of this time. There are two references to the U.S. Code, which is one in this section and one later. I wonder.
Well, I don't think if it is as of the effective date of this code, if the court could construe it that way, or if the effective date of this act could construe it that way to hold a constitution?
Well, I
remember on the House Tax Committee, when we tied something in like that, we tied it down to a certain date.
Well,
Mr. Chairman,
I was merely going to say that we haven't seen here really adopted by reference the substance of the federal statute. We merely referred to the merit reduction in effect, which is provided for in the federal state tax.
Still, by amending that section, Congress has changed the merit reduction which is provided for,
Mr. Chairman. If you think it would be clearer, that can be added in this place and the other place,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
There is a case coming up from the Department of Agriculture, which essentially
rule language like this constitutional by the court saying, obviously what the legislature meant was as amended effective a certain date. I think it's, we're running a totally unnecessary risk if we leave the language the way it is.
I think on line 27 after amended, we should have as of the effective date of this act.
Right.
Senator Byrne so moves.
Well, I've got a very technical one again.
The effective date of this act in
1970, a Congress may amend during then, which would affect between the time we enact this legislation and the time it becomes effective. I think you work this out for as the way it is now.
I think as of the effective date of the act, otherwise,
what
are the dates you take? The dates they will consider?
This is a prospective code.
Congress may amend this between now and the effective date of this act.
But how else to tie it down?
As of now.
As date?
As of the date of the passage of this act. Not as of the effective date, but the date of the passage of this act. Should become effective. We do the emergency clause all the time.
You ought to pick out a specific day. Passage is a little ambiguous.
We're still,
this hasn't been met. Like, why don't we say as of January 1, 1969?
I think that's better.
That's my mission, Mr.
Senator. You've all heard the motion, Burns and Lent. All those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. Apply the deck.
Subsection 3 of this section provides that the income which is received during the administration of the trust and is distributed to a trustee shall be treated as income of the trust. Section 169 and the following sections have to do with the distribution and the closing of the estate. Section 169 provides for a partial distribution. This is a much more simplified procedure than we have under our present statutes. There are three things that need to be done in order to entitle a partial distribution of the estate. The first is that there either has to be a release from the state treasurer on inheritance tax or he must consent to the distribution. Second, there must be a showing that after the distribution, there is enough left in the estate to pay the support of the spouse and children and expenses of administration, unpaid claims, that sort of thing. And third, that the distribution can be made without any loss to the creditor or injury to the estate or to an interested party. Essentially, these are safeguards that are set up so that when an order is made, it isn't discovered subsequently that something has been distributed out which should still be in the hands of the personal representative. I think essentially the under the present code, you must have a release from the state treasurer or his consent in writing. You've got to notify him of the hearing. These others are two and three essentially give to the court wide latitude in determining whether it's a case that a partial distribution should be made. Section 170 says that the court requires a condition to a partial distribution that the distributee put up a bond or other security for the protection of any creditor or interested party who might be injured by reason of the partial distribution.
One question on that. The title of that says undertaking of distributee, but I don't see, maybe I've overlooked it, I don't see anything in the effective language that says that the bond is to be filed by the distributor.
Well, I think you're perhaps right, Mr. Chairman. It could be that we should insert the court may require the distributee to furnish a bond or other security.
From the distributee.
May require from the distributee.
Well, that word, the court may require a bond or other security of the district.
Well, yes.
I think that's better. Line 24 after the word security of the distributee. Motion. You've heard the motion. Any discussion? Not all those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. 171.
This section provides that the distribution made by a personal representative under this section relieves him of personal liability as far as the property that is distributed is concerned.
Should there be any, I'm thinking a lot of things probably, should there be anything in section 171 to cover the situation where the personal representative is a party to a fraud or misrepresentation that results in the partial disposition?
I think there.
I think that would do it under a property or.
Yes, and further than that, you still have all of your equitable remedies where you have fraud, which wouldn't in any way relieve this dignity of liability to someone who had been defrauded.
Do you think there's any danger that the personal representatives, the person who puts up the bond, the corporation who puts up the bond, might escape some liability by this section for the wrongful act in the sense of fraud and misrepresentation by the personal representative? I mean, pretty broad discharge here.
Well, I would just say this. I think that any time a personal representative makes a misrepresentation to the court with regard to the distribution, and he is a moving party, let us assume, in your instance, that he couldn't rely upon this statute to say I'm discharged.
I would be, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy with it, except as provided in this chapter or something.
Same thing.
Referring to the other obligations of the
person that was throughout the rest of the
I would suggest
that change.
What was your suggestion?
Except as provided in this chapter.
Section 1 through 212
of hearing.
1 to 212 of this act
is that
Section is what?
1 to 212 of this act.
I know about.
I think so. You're going to hit this several other times where you may want to consider putting in this every place. If you put it in one place and not another, yeah. You may give an implication. You may already pass them.
Could we ask the legislative council to search for those and perhaps see any other appropriate places, Mr. Chairman?
Would you do that?
Try to find them.
All right. Is there a motion?
Yes.
Heard the motion. Any discussion? Not all those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Carried.
Section 172 is a rather odd provision, and I really didn't realize we have it in our present code, but what it in effect says that if a partial distribution is made and it's subsequently discovered that this property is needed for the payment of claims or inheritance taxes, the personal representative can file a petition for the return of the property. Notice is given then to the distributee, a hearing is had by the court, and the court can then order, if he deems it necessary, the distributee to return the property, or if he no longer has it, to pay the face value of the property back to the personal representative within a specified time. If the property isn't returned, the person failing to return it can be adjudged to be in contempt, and a judgment can be entered against him, and if he's put up a bond against his sureties.
Mr. Chairman, do you want notice and sureties prior to the time as a judgment to be entered against him? Should the surety have notice of the hearing?
I would think that the surety wouldn't be bound unless it had notice.
So
So I think you either got to remove the judgment against the surety below, or better, say notice of the hearing on the petition begins with the exclusion of this act to the surety and his surety of any.
Well, section 13, which reference made a notice, says that you have to give a notice. The date, time, place of the hearing will be given to each person interested in the subject of the hearing or to his attorney.
Attorney, surety. This now goes into the account of the liability of the personal representative. The rules here laid down are pretty common sense rules. The personal representative is chargeable with all the property that comes into his possession, including the income therefrom. Also, property that isn't a part of the estate, if he mixes it up with assets of the estate, or if he gets property which he receives under a duty imposed on him by law as a personal representative. Gene and I were talking about this category. We don't really know what that property would consist of, but maybe somebody knows a little better than we do about that.
Chairman, personal representative is charged with his accounts with property not a part of the estate if it's commingled with assets of the estate. He takes $1,000 of estate assets and commingles it with $10,000 of other assets that are not a part of his estate. Do you read this to mean that
he's chargeable in his account?
Liable for. Does that subject him to some liability in the amount of that $10,000?
So that was the feeling. I think we were referring to jointly held assets, perhaps, that might come into the hands of the personal representative at the same time that he was administering the state.
Well, you're charging for is the assets of the estate that he's coming.
Your point is he's going to be liable for the other $9,000 or $10,000 belong to him. Right.
Where did we get this code section? These are adopted from the model probate code, essentially, although and some similar provisions in the Iowa probate code. This particular section, I think, is one that is new. That's commingling, I think, and some others.
Maybe I'm being too literal in reading 13. Does it concern you with the possibility?
I think that the court never would require the personal representative to account for more than what actually belonged to the estate.
You say all property not, you make it as explicit as you can, all property not a part of the estate if it's commingled. I mean, it's a pretty explicit direction. You include that with $9,000.
Well, of course, if we're talking with money, it's something that could be segregated. I think you're probably figuring on maybe non-segregatable assets of property that was not a part of the estate, and estate assets were used to buy a piece of real property. It could be segregated.
Is liable for and chargeable of the accounts to the extent of the interest of this estate or something? That's what I'm talking about.
Don, would it satisfy you if we said may be liable for and is chargeable in his account with?
I'm not as happy as I might be. I want to be as happy as I might be. I'm worried about the words all property. In line 16, you make a specific direction that you're charging with all property.
Mr. Chairman, may I try to
please do
give some light on this? I don't say I can, but my recollection is when we talk about commingling property, the first thing that comes to mind is the kind of thing that gets attorneys disbarred, in that they're putting clients' funds in the wrong estate. Now, if you are receiving trust assets and put it into the estate account, you obviously are legally chargeable for that money that you put in the estate bank account. That's the first thing that comes to mind. And when we're talking about property, that's going to include funds that you are depositing in the estate bank account. And obviously, you're legally chargeable and legally responsible for that money if you're going to put it in the estate bank account wrongfully. Now, the other C, as I read the comment, which I apologize because it's not very, obviously not very clear, but the C is property which has been conveyed to the personal representative, that is the executor and the administrator, when by rights the property should have been conveyed to one of the heirs.
I think that we accomplished every bit that we desire here. We simply say a personal representative is chargeable in any of the accounts with, and eliminate that. If he's chargeable with them, he may be liable also.
I have no objection to that. I just tried to explain what we're trying to cover.
Mr. Allison, I lost you though. You said in C.
There
isn't a C in Leiden.
I think you meant B.
I mean B. I'm B. Sorry, I got.
Well, I can think an example of B, although it's
probably suggestion, Doug.
Well,
basically,
sure. I think we really accomplish the same thing. Senator Wilner moves that on line 13, we delete the words liable for and.
Chargeable, I understand, means he has a duty of reporting.
That's right. He's chargeable. He's short. We're going to talk about other provisions here. He's short for his stuff.
I can see 18 and 19. It did not have a double thinking what that might
be. I couldn't tell.
I can think of one example. You get an action for damages for death, an wrongful act of another, and the only people who can possibly benefit, and not the estate as such, but say a surviving spouse and dependents, it isn't available. He's a general creditor.
You've heard the motion. Any further discussion? Leaving words liable for and.
He seems to have.
May I ask?
Yes.
Is if you delete liable for and surety, does it bond cover this? Can we only say charge of one account?
Tony, how about a personal representative is liable for to the extent of the interest of this estate, or to the extent of the damage to this estate.
I'll withdraw my lower motion.
Let the record show. If liable is needed for the surety, then liable for to the extent of the interest of this estate.
To the extent of the estate's interest, then?
Well, then, by golly, your B doesn't fit anymore, the example I just gave. Because that isn't the estate. In the wrongful death action, improperly called, the ordinary thing of wrongful death action, the personal representative acts to collect it. There is a surviving spouse or dependency act to collect for them, but it's not a part of the estate as such, subject to the claims of creditors and so on.
Mr. Chairman, I move the attorney motion. May be liable for.
And is charged.
And is charged.
The motion has been restated. You've all heard it. All in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion's carried. All right.
Subsection 3 delineates the other liabilities of the personal representative for loss arising to the estate if he neglects or delays unreasonably in collecting assets, or if he neglects to deliver over money or property belonging to the estate, if he fails to pay taxes, impose the estate for an unreasonable time, if he steals from the estate or he mixes up his assets, mixes up other assets with the estate, if he has unauthorized self-dealing.
Where is this? Where? He had self-dealing, how far back?
That was probably under the.
That made him avoidable.
Sales and property.
It made him voidable.
Yeah.
That's what that was.
Voidable.
It was a voidable issue.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Stand there with that.
The, if you sell...
Where is it? One second.
It's on the left-hand side of the bottom page.
132.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir. Go ahead, Bob.
Tenderland, do you want to discuss the claim line?
It's the section 132, and it's on the left-hand side of the bottom of the page. I wanted to say this. I think we can read faster than the top. But the thing I'm getting, get down to line 30 and 31, and I'm just interested. I'm sure this is just an attempt to cover everything, but any other negligent or willful act or non-feasance. Now, what did you have in mind for non-feasance that wouldn't be covered under negligence or willful act? Of course, or even just negative. Negligent or willful act. Is there anything non-feasance that wouldn't be covered?
I think we've always had some difference between misfeasance and non-feasance.
But they're both part of negligence, right?
Well, I'm not sure they are always. I think this was a catch-all.
Okay. I'm not going to worry about this. I had something specific in mind. 174.
174. Says that the personal representative isn't liable for debts due to the decedent or assets of the estate which remain uncollected without his fault or loss or decrease in value of the property if it's such loss that he caused by his fault. Quite a substantial improvement on our present code. It outlines what shall be contained in the accountings to be filed by the personal representative. You'll notice in subparagraph A that the filing must be yearly instead of on each 6 month period. And subparagraph B, if he removes or resigns, he's got to file it within 30 days from the date of his resignation or removal. Then subsection C, line 14, tells you what has to go into the final account. We do not have any definitive list of the things that go into the final reported account. As far as the accounting is concerned, starting with line 15, or 16 rather, each account shall include the following information. You can skip down through there. A, it says it's a period of time that the account covers. B is what the personal representative is chargeable with. C is the monies and property that's come in during the course of the account. D is the disbursements. We made the provision that the vouchers do not necessarily have to be filed with the report or account. This is because some courts don't want them filed anymore. They're so voluminous.
Mr. Chairman, don't we have to cross-reference with this other VA's bill? Should we cross-reference that here? Unless the law is provided by order or rule of the court or...
we did make an exception that was passed out.
Oh, it was just passed out of our committee. Wasn't that the House bill?
That was where the VA is. Was it in the states or were it a guardian? Guardianship.
It was in a guardianship.
I think so.
I'll let the council.
Yeah.
It was expressly where they were already making their accounting and the Secretary of State gave him a check.
No.
Back to the policy decision. Lines 10 and 11, now, as Robert pointed out, this is annually now instead of semi-annually. Can we get some idea of the, since everything else in this thing has sort of been a speed-up idea, not let them go along, why the departure here? It seems to me that semi-annually, that would be the accounting, things don't get lost and delayed on your guess.
First, I'll answer this from a purely personal basis. I think that it's a waste of time in 9 cases out of 10 to have to file any interim accounting. I really do. I think that most of the estates that we deal with, you're in close contact with personal representative, and very often that personal representative is a principal heir. And here every 6 months you have to run up to the court and file your accounting to get an order approving it. I think most of us on both committees felt that semi-annually was too often.
The thing that bothers me is when we go to sell this, this is a revision. One of the big reasons is that cutting down the time of probate and so on.
One other thing cutting down expense.
Well, but the C, though, however, when the estate is ready to find a settlement distribution,
or D.
Or D. I think it takes care of it. Actually, common practice generally is that you do this under C.
We were hoping that all the estates would be probated before the 1 year, so we wouldn't have a lot of time. Because it
isn't that big a thing. I'm just wondering if it's safe out there. I know it's awful easy to let 6 by 6 months go by if you don't have to do anything.
926 subsection E actually is a schedule which shows the remaining assets on hand at the time of the filing of the account. F says that he should give such other information as he thinks that people are entitled to or the court may require. Now, subsection 3, line 30, talks about what you do when the estate is ready for filing. And A is the same provision that we have in our law now, that you get to file a clearance from the state tax commission, state treasurer, also show that the personal property tax has been paid, or you got to file proof that there's a bond or other deposit. B is a petition authorizing the distribution, telling who you're going to distribute it to, and the proportions in which they are to receive it. Subparagraph 4 is one that I worked out. It simply provides that if the beneficiaries consent in writing, you don't have to furnish all of this other material on the left-hand side. And I'm talking about the case where the widow is the sole beneficiary. In that event, all she has to do is to say, subparagraph A on line 7, the time covered by the accounting, B, a statement that all creditors have been paid, and then C, you've got to show the payment of the inheritance tax, estate income, and so forth. This provision should be very helpful in expediting the closing of an estate. 176 is the filing of the final account. The personal representative does not any longer give published notice, but at least 20 days before the time fixed in the notice, he's got to notify line 17 each heir, if the decedent died intestate, 18 each devisee, if he died testate, 19 each creditor who has not been paid in full, 20 D, rather, any person known to the PR who has an interest in the estate. A notice doesn't have to be mailed to the personal representative. It's the widow that's not required. And then subparagraph 3 requires a proof of mailing be filed in an affidavit form.
Now,
you realize it?
Sorry. Well, I was going to say, immediately after this, having an interruption, this is a really appropriate place, because representatives of the press are here. Mr. Levine, who's the chairman of the Legislative Committee of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association, is here, and I think perhaps this is the appropriate time to hear the newspaper people.
Mr. Chairman, may I? This has been amended earlier, this section, to include the border control and the notice sent.
Yes, that was the intention. Phil, do you wish to have a chair come forward?
Okay.
I might say to you, for whatever it's worth, that earlier in the publication of notice to creditors, two things. One, this committee amended that to from 2 to 3 weeks. And secondly, I would call your attention that the material that is required to be included in the notice is substantially more than it is at the present time. So that preface you.
Okay.
We also beg our Oregon
industry. Well, Mr. Chairman, as your chairman has said, I'm chairman of the Legislative Committee of the Publishers Association. I might tell you some of the fellows that are here. Bill Mainwaring from the Capital Journal, back of me, who is president this year of ONPA. and Jack McClung, Assistant Classified Ad Manager of the Oregonian Urban Journal, and John Nelson from Springfield, who is the immediate past president of ONPA, and John Morrow from Blue Mountain Eagle, and John Day, Pete King from Oregon City, the Enterprise Courier, Rex Layton, the Classified Ad Manager of the Statesman Journal, and Ralph Rose from the Silverton Appeal Tribune, Jack Zimmerman from the Press in Portland, Jack Young, Classified Ad Manager of the Eugene Register Guard, and Carl Webb, the manager of ONPA. Frankly, we're in a pretty difficult position on this thing because we are not certainly in any way opposed to streamlining the probate procedures. We do have some concern with some of these things. If you have some questions to throw at me, perhaps I can field some, and certainly I'd like to call on the other fellows who are here to help out, because one of the things that we're a little bit concerned about, and I think perhaps you are too, that this is a pretty substantial change, and there is almost no public knowledge throughout the state of what's happening on it. I think that the attorneys have had a substantial amount of discussion on it, but outside of that, even on these hearings, the press notice hasn't been good, and this is one of the problems. I've kicked this thing around quite a little bit, and yet we may be off base in some of the things that we think, because we really don't know what's in here to a large extent. I've tried to read some of it, but I'm not an attorney. I have copies of our statements, which I will give to you, and in view of what the chairman has said, we are perhaps off on a little of this. But when the state assumes a role in the marshaling and distribution of the assets of an estate, it also assumes an obligation to afford due process to all interested parties, unknown heirs, unknown creditors, and others interested in the estate. Due process, at the minimum, requires notice plus the machinery whereby contested matters can be adjudicated. Notice means alerting all interested parties, including in particular those who would not otherwise be aware that their interests are in possible jeopardy. The most effective notice is, of course, personal notice, but it is axiomatic that if there are parties to whose interest is not known to those responsible for notice, personal notice is not possible. Further, the self-interest of individuals responsible for notice may make them less diligent in seeking out all interested parties. Published notice in a newspaper fulfills the requirements of due process more effectively and efficiently than any other alternative method. It is easily accomplished because there is a local newspaper in each county of Oregon readily available and prepared to provide notice every week in the year. Newspapers are experienced in providing this service of distributing the notice to hundreds or thousands of homes and offices. Some reader will recognize the interest of an otherwise unaware party and advise him if he has not already read the notice himself. No other method of achieving notice to unknown parties combines this simplicity, accessibility, and wide reach. It permits the administration of an estate to move ahead without undue delay. Time required to fulfill the due process demands is neatly capsuled into the period necessary for preparation of the notice and its publication in the newspaper. Published newspaper notice becomes more useful and necessary as the administration of estates is streamlined and expedited. It is a protection to the unknown person who may have some interest in the probate matter. We question the wisdom of eliminating by repeal, as proposed in Senate Bill 506, certain provisions of Oregon law which have proved workable and adequate within the passage of time. Specifically, we oppose the repeal of sections which provide for the following notices to be published in a newspaper of general circulation published within the county in which the action is commenced. The repeal of notice to creditors, repeal of notice of final settlement, repeal of notice of intent to sell real property, repeal of notice to public sale of real property, and amending ORS 126-441 by deleting publication provisions, a notice of public or private sale of real property. And we suggest that if the committee decides to give favorable consideration to Senate Bill 506, that amendments be prepared which will either restore the present law relating to publication of notices or substitute suitable provision for public notice via publication in a newspaper. I'll give you copies of that. Frankly, myself, I've been concerned in looking at this with the elimination of some of these notices, I think that they do not shorten the time of the estate. I noticed, for example, there was an article on the bill that was in the Eugene Register Garden, which it pointed out that one of the means of shortening the time was by the elimination of the published notices requiring 6 months between the settling of the estate. Well, the notices could require 4 months to, or whatever time you want to settle the estate. The published notice isn't what's going to do it. It's the time that's set by the law. And so the elimination of that notice is not the answer. I'm concerned about the few cases which might come up in which there, through publication of information, certain people might not be aware of what's going on. I don't think we're talking about a cost factor. And the publication of notices is a very minor item in the estate. I know what they cost in earnings paper, for example, and it's almost basically the same in all papers.
Pass them around. Go right ahead, Senator.
The Law Improvement Committee and its advisory committee worked on this code, I think, for 4 years. And there's been a tremendous amount of publication or publicity about it as far as the bar is concerned. And they had public hearings, as I understand it, around the state and received innumerable suggestions from interested people and wrote and rewrote drafts. Did your association make its views known to them in the course of this 4 year period?
Certainly, I know I didn't. Carl Webb probably could answer that better than I can. Frankly, I've even talked to some of our attorneys about this, and they're a little vague on what.
I'm really surprised at that because it's been so much in the forefront as far as the bar is concerned.
I know that in the preparation of the National Uniform Code, which is somewhat follows, of course, there's been strong representations made on the publication of notices and in the preparation of that code.
Would the position of your association be that we should leave the publication provisions of the probate code the way they are now?
Perhaps, or basically with some changes.
Do you have any specific recommendations?
Well, we've discussed it to some extent. I certainly want to spend more time with our people if we were going to get into some specific recommendations. One of the things in the notice of final settlement, as we were discussing this earlier among ourselves, I think that the liability of the personal representative is stopped, but within a year's time. So to me, this would seem that if a final settlement notice is not published, that this could jeopardize that for the interests of people who might have an interest in the estate that didn't know. These, I realize, are peculiar cases, but they do happen.
This concerns me because newspapers are supposed to be the leaders in the community and in the state, and you come in the 11th hour. And frankly, I recognize the position that the drafters of the probate code are in because Senator Turi and Senator Glenn and myself are now and have for the last year or so been deeply involved in the drawing of our new criminal code. As we prepare our drafts, we're sending them out, soliciting views, and pointing toward the presentation of this project for the 71 session. And I can foresee the position that we will be in on the eve of adjournment of the 1971 session when we're getting ready to pass this project, which we put so much work, and then have a rather substantial and influential group come in who never previously raised their voices and object.
Did Senator, did you in your district contact any of the newspaper people, for example, and discuss it with them?
With respect to this?
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Kaplan has
communicated with me, yes, but only within within the last couple of weeks.
No one has ever, for example, sat down with me and discussed the probate code, and the code, and I would question.
But I am aware, in fact, as much as a year ago, I guess in justice to the David Attorney Congress of Portland, they were aware of the preliminary drafts that were cutting back on the publications, and they had made their wishes known at that time.
Well, perhaps I better ask Carl if any representations had ever been made to the association or the committee.
Well, they have not been read, or I know I've never been invited to talk to on any meeting.
Mr. Chairman Wilner.
We got three places of potential publication. First of all, when the state starts and you publish initial notice to creditors, the community heard. We've left that in. We've cut down some on the number of times of publication. I suppose any number of times you pick as an arbitrary. Like 20 times better notice than 5, you know. Alright, then you have a notice of sale of real property, and you've long been able to waive that by capital provisions in the will. In most terms of your wills, put in provision saying, waive that. And then the third possible time is what we're talking about in this section, which is at the end of the estate. At this point, you pretty well know who was interested in this age. And what we're providing here is really actual notice to all the people who are interested. And so when we keep the publication at the beginning, which is essentially when we're saying, all ye who are interested, come in, isn't this really the important place, and aren't these aren't these other publications really of far less significance, recognizing that you can always achieve more notice by more publications, but I haven't really covered the basics.
Well, to take it first, as I understand it, the notice to creditors is taken to three times.
Right.
Frankly, I would like to personally and it could be included in the notice to creditors if necessary, the notice of the appointment of the personal representative, who it is. It is, okay. All right, then I do not like to see the notice of sale of real property removed from this. And again, as you say, most of the time it is not going to be done, but I can see specific times and have that I would prefer not to see that out.
That would wait now.
Yes, I realize you can waive it now but that's in the type of estate where it doesn't make any difference. Because
what type of estate does it make a difference?
In an estate, I'm getting into a legal situation which I probably am not in a position to discuss because, as I said in the first place, I may be wrong on the premise to start out with. I would think that in an estate that in which there was not a will, or an estate in which there were heirs that were not closely available, and if the personal administrator could go ahead and the personal representative could sell property, because as I understand it under this code, he has a great deal more leeway than the executor has had in the past.
He's going to give the heirs initial notice of the opening of the estate.
He has to mail it?
Under this, the heirs, once the estate is open, whether it's a will or not a will, the heirs are immediately going to be told it's an estate. The heirs in Ireland or Australia, wherever they are, going to be told it's an estate heir. And they're the people who are you're protecting them by giving them something even more important than publication, giving them actual notice.
Is it possible then that you have an estate in which no one has an interest who isn't known at that time to that personal representative at such time as he wants to sell property?
Well, he's going to give notice at the opening of the estate to all of the heirs and devisees. We're going to have publication
to give notice to creditors.
Yeah.
So we're bringing into the ballpark the two groups we're concerned with right then.
And at that point, that eliminates all further public interest or knowledge of what happens in the estate, right?
No, you're getting the interest of people in there, and there is the people who have a right to complain are in there, and their account is published. And their final account is made available to people who define as having interest.
At such time as the personal representative could sell property, he has to tell everybody in the estate he's going to do it.
I'm letting your question assumes that you do get all the interested parties, that you know all the potential parties today. You give notice to them to begin with.
Well, I'm assuming that by your initial provision of notice and by your initial...
How do you give notice to unknown buyers?
And your original notification to heirs that you're getting people in. I don't see that by publishing a notice in the paper, unless you're the contrary, that we're about to sell such and such real property. That this tells unknown heirs anything or puts unknown heirs on further.
Well, just because of the fact that these people turn up all the time. When you have publications of notice, we're not going to argue about three or four times on publication of a notice to creditors. I personally think that four times is fine because there's too many people that are getting 3-week vacations now. There's way too many getting 3-week vacations. But anyway, people are gone. With the 2 weeks, I was going to fight real hard on because there's too much chance of people being gone during that period of time. 3 weeks, yeah, you can catch them, you can also miss them. But somebody is going to pick it up and know it. Public notices are very well read. Carl was talking about it tonight.
Now you lost me.
Readership studies, the public notice readership in weekly papers is very, very hot. And surprisingly, even more than I would think. But I think that there are people turned up all of the time who are not known, as Senator Lent says, the unknown heirs and that sort of thing. And I think this publication, if property is going to be sold, and if it's written into the will that it doesn't have to be, that's perfectly all right. If that's the intent of the man or the person making the will, that's fine. But if there is property in there and it's going to be sold and there's a potential heir who does not know about it, or if there's an interest of someone in the estate that doesn't know that the property is going to be sold, then I think they should be protected. And we're talking peanuts. I don't know why, if there's any protection there, that we should take it out. And again, I think the final settlement, these aren't holding up the estate. We're talking about
Senator Gernstad, I think he...
Well, the thing that always bothers me about it, I don't know if you're correct me there, it seems to me that on a local basis, say you're in a newspaper in Yankee, sure, you publish the notice, but the chances are pretty good that any of the interested parties there would know. What bothers me is that maybe some of the unknown heirs or creditors may end up here.
The
notice doesn't tell me.
Yeah, Ken, but what happens, for example, on my newspaper, we get repercussions back from around the world. Because particularly in a small town, and every one of these folks can tell you the same thing, when people leave our community, they take that local newspaper with them. We're sending the paper to people who lived in our community 10 and 20 years ago. And we have a good many hundreds of copies that go out all over the United States, and we get feedback from these. It's surprising we even have people order merchandise on ads that they see from across the country. And those people who are the people who have a direct interest with other families in our community. And there is, it's surprising where these things are picked up.
You might have gotten me on that. Now name the newspaper at Wheeler County.
I can't, Kim.
The common one goes in there, but it's not published.
Thoughts and Jeremy.
Chairman, I'd like to make a comment, I think, with regard to this matter of the notice of the hearing on the final account, which is, I think, prompted the discussion. Referring to section 141, subsection 4, we provided in this code that a claim is barred if it's not filed before the filing of the final account.
So if the purpose of the discussion is to protect late filing creditors, we're not going to accomplish anything by publishing at that time because the final report and account will have already been filed and the claim will have been barred. So it can't benefit any late filing creditors.
That's true under the present law, too.
I'm thinking, yeah. I think the gentleman, at least according to mail, more things than just the notice of final account. They're taking notices of sale of property and so on. Yeah. And in addition to the fact that people who move from a community may have their own hometown paper sent to them, at least on a weekly basis. People in town who remember somebody who left oftentimes bring across the notice and write to a friend with them. I don't know it. I see no reason, really. It's actually such a can small expense to sort of knock out what at least might be considered a due process requirement.
Well, due process at which, what's the term?
Yes.
Due process at which point?
All right, I'll admit, you got the section 95 provides for publication of notice of the appointment of the personal representative, and so on. Which may be enough to satisfy all constitutional problems on due process. That may be enough.
Every will I write in there a waiver of publication for the sale of real property.
I do too, but everybody doesn't die with a will.
Well, but then you have a due process.
What do you mean you don't have due process problems? Just if you don't die with a will?
Can be and is routinely waived by every attorney who writes this.
I say, but there are a few people who still die without having a will.
I'd like to ask a question, Senator, of why in both the National Uniform Code and in this, is there such an emphasis to eliminate these publications?
Well, I don't know why there is in the National Code or even in this, but this particular publication doesn't do anybody any good at all.
On sale of property?
No, the one that we're on, 176 we're on right now. I haven't heard anything that says that this particular publication does anybody any good at all, with one exception. And therefore, it's hard to see the reason for it. You're asking me why something's going on, and there was some comments earlier that I thought weren't germane to the issue. I want to use something that's useful. I don't want to do an unnecessary thing. If it can be demonstrated that it's useful and important.
Can I ask Mr. Webb?
Is there discussion that?
176, the final notice, I can't see how it does anything except, as a matter of fact, to prolong the estate.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to interrupt something, but I thought that you said this was as good a time as any.
That's right.
To go to this whole problem.
Yeah.
The publication of notices.
I certainly have no objection to that. I just don't want to argue about the notice on final account anymore, unless there is a reason where it does somebody some good.
I think, really, gentlemen, that we see the point quite clearly, Phil, that you're interested in. And unless there's additional testimony that introduces something new, I frankly don't think there's anything to be gained by repeating.
No.
Or arguing about this point, and then you will take it into consideration, unless you have something...
I'd like to ask Mr. Webb just this one thing on the notice of final settlement, because he had some comments on that tonight.
The only point that I can see in the notice of final settlement is, number one, it sets a definite time, makes public that time, gives the unknown or the interested persons under our present law a 4-week period before the actual final hearing. And is that additional protection? Which, again, if everyone is properly notified and read or got word of the original publication, that would be necessary. But supposing that they have not, when you come up to the closing of the estate, then he can still come in up until the time of the final hearing.
Phil, I think
with or without the newspaper,
people in the community read stories more than they do the
actually a notice. Why don't you just write a little story and finally?
Carl's readership survey showed that 1 out of 4 read the public notices, and that, I'm amazed. But
thank you very much.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
And we'll consider your position.
You want to return to 177?
Uh, 177 simply says that anyone interested in the estate can file an objection to the final account, and he must specify the particulars of his objection, which is essentially our present code provision. Upon the filing of the objections, the court then has set the time for a hearing on the objection. Have been filed, and after the hearing, the court then enters its decree of final distribution. This decree is, as you will notice, it outlines most of this page 66 as to what shall be contained in the decree. And the purpose for that is to make this decree a final and conclusive entry from which there can only be appeal taken, and if there's no appeal taken, then of course it becomes final and binding.
Yes.
Aren't there another alternative? The court, upon the hearing, instead of entering it to give us a clear final distribution, might send the person representative back to do some other things?
Yes.
Is that allowed in this language?
I think on the next section there, section 179 at the top of the next page, the court may disapprove the account in whole or in part, surcharge the personal representative, and so forth.
You won't be able to shall realistically by the institutions. Shall.
I don't think so. And a number of these matters would not appear in the ordinary decree of standards, such as advancements, election, and so forth. But the essential parts of it, which would be in almost every decree, would be 918, subsection 2, showing that the personal representative in the state is State of Oregon income tax, inheritance tax, and so forth, and he's filed his proper releases. Subsection 3 is a new provision, and that provides that where the parties agree upon a distribution of the estate that's different than is set forth in the will or than would be under the intestate law, that such a provision is valid and the property actually will be transferred in accordance with that agreement if the court agrees with it, and the decree there operates as a transfer to the property. Subparagraph 4 is the one that says that the decree is a conclusive determination subject only to the right of appeal.
179
provides that if the account is approved, the personal representative and his surety are relieved from liability for the administration of the estate, and then as was previously noted, the court can disapprove the account in whole or in part, in which event he can surcharge the personal representative for any loss, and he can deny him all of his compensation or a part of it.
180
again is a detailed description of what happens on the distribution of the estate. There are certain situations where there perhaps is not enough to go around, and this actually sets up the manner in which distribution is going to be made in the event that there is not an adequate amount in the estate to pay all the requests. here again, you've got a rather unique situation. You don't encounter it in many states. In drawing this section, you might read them what the comments of the advisory committee are on this. That's section 179 of our code.
Well, section 179 apparently is taken from section 3-602 of the Uniform Probate Code. Follows the plan of abatement set out in ORS 116-720, 116-730, 735, 117-330. The present statutory plan of abatement is modified because the proposed code makes no distinction, of course, between his real and personal property, as you understand. And titled to both real and personal property vested in the heir or devisees at the moment of death of the deceased. Subsection 2 preserves the abatement as separately provided in the section of the proposed code on pre-permitted heirs and election of the surviving spouse to take against the will. Subsection 4, which is adapted from the New York statute on pre-permitted heirs, but except from abatement, specific requests of tangible personal property, such as articles of jewelry, art objects, and other gifts, which are not properly susceptible of being subjected to abatement.
Why do we get into the use of the word gift? Definition section, trying to get the advice was going to cover everything.
Where did you see that?
Subsection.
Lines 30 and 31, we start talking about a gift, all of a sudden about gift. Any reason for departing from.
I think you're right. I think that perhaps was an editorial mistake.
Copied from the Uniform Code. Right. Not consistent.
It should be nice, Judge.
Right.
On line 30 and 31, motion by Senator Lent is we need the word if and substitute therefore the word device. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? No. Carry.
Aye. We carry the day.
Oh, wait a minute here now. What was that vote?
181 provides.
This table the code.
This is a new provision in our code. It simply says that if a pecuniary bequest is not paid, a device is not paid within a year from the date of death, or rather the appointment of a personal representative, then they pay 3% interest on the bequest. I was in favor of 6% interest myself because the California code does raise it to 6%.
The things we've got in this state that is long overdue in light of present economic conditions is to
raise our interest
6% on judgments, for instance. God, if I get a judgment against you, it's the greatest thing in the world for you to refuse to pay it and file a notice of in effect borrow money from me. I supersede his bond at 6%.
That's true on 6%, but actually, you know, the personal representative in a normal case is going to have this in a savings account or something like that.
Sorry. Who's phase 5?
Yes.
We had a lot of argument back and forth whether it should be 6, but we were lucky to get 3 in.
For the record, I'm in the mood this time. We change that in line 3 to 5.
You've heard the motion. Is there any discussion?
What's the model?
What section is it on?
184 here.
I'm 181.
It's probably different. It's such a condition.
No, I have the great adventure.
Do you have the section number?
Only the bill number.
But you have the section of the Uniform Code.
No, I don't have it.
Well, yeah, it's 3-604 in the Uniform. 3-604. Well, I just have it referenced. Am I Am I not?
Says the legal rate.
Which is 6% in this one.
The motion is 5%. Any discussion?
As Tony says, a lot of times it's going to be in a bank. Practically every bank or savings and loan is paying at least 5%.
Let me ask you a question. Isn't it possible for the pecuniary device to be paid over